It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Humiliated in spectacular fashion, voters in France sending a loud and strong message to the country's mainstream elites, rejecting the far-left candidates and sending the election into a runoff May 7th between populist Marine Le Pen and centrist Emmanuel Macron, both candidates sounding energized by the shift in the country's politics.
It is time to free the French people from arrogant elites who want to dictate their behavior because, yes, I am the candidate of the people.
Your duty to continue to pursue this vibrant commitment until the end and beyond. Never give up, never forget those months during which you have changed the course of our country.
In the final results, Macron had just over 23%, while Le Pen had 21%. And the reaction from French voters suggests this was not only welcomed, but long overdue.
We need a change in leadership, you know, after 5 years which have not been great.
I wanted to vote for France and to make sure that we make the good choice.
France needs to reform and we need to make sure that it's done well and rapidly.
This is angry protesters clashed with the police and took to the streets, rioting, setting bonfires and burning cars. Some 29 protesters arrested. And so many folks waking up to these events and results, noting the similarities between the French election and our own election. Guys, it seems we've seen this story before.
Absolutely.
All right. That was Griff Jenkins of Fox News. This is Sandy Rios with you. And in case you have been having a weekend and not watching the news, you have to know that yesterday was a very big day in France. Something like thousands of policemen were called out to make sure that the people of France could vote in safety. 78% actually did turn out to vote. And you've already heard the results. Two non-establishment candidates. Sound familiar? Emmanuel Macron with 23% and Marie Le Pen with 21%, with very different views on how to govern France. And the runoff will be May the 7th. So really, we can read all of these things, we can hear reports from Fox, but I wanted a firsthand report from a Frenchman. And so we've asked Jean Martinez to join us this morning. He's a lawyer with the Bar of Marseille, France. He's the vice president of the Institut de Formation Politique. Forgive my French, Jean. And bonjour. bonjour, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sammy.
All right. So, Jean, let me just ask, you know, there were terrorist attacks last week. Please, could I just say to you first, there are millions of us on this side of the ocean who are praying for the people of France. We are just praying for you in this election, praying for you as you've gone through so much this last few years with all these terrorist attacks. And we're very concerned about your country and your people. So I just want to say that right up front.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. And with all of those, with the attacks that happened last week, the terrorist attacks where a policeman and another man were killed, were the people of France afraid to vote yesterday?
I don't think so. I wouldn't say that. But the thing is, perhaps it is because we are just getting used to it. If you take the sequence of the last 2 years, beginning with the January 2015 attacks on the Charlie Hebdo newspaper, up to just a few days ago on the Champs-Élysées, the policeman who got killed, we have been reminded on a very constant basis that terror attacks may take place in France. So it is not good news, but in some way, we are getting used to it. This is the reason why, even though the news of that policeman killed in the middle of the Champs-Élysées created some effect on the TV, because it was in the middle of the auditions of the different candidates, So, of course, there were comments around that. But I don't think it created an effect on the voters. And one of the illustrations of that non-effect is the fact that Marine Le Pen, whose vote is certainly one of the most sensitive to these security and terrorism issues, actually her result is more or less in line with what the polls said.
Yeah, that in itself was a bit of a surprise, wasn't it? I think, you know, because of our experience in our last election, and you know that the United States mirrors Europe in so many ways, because I think, I'll just say, the left is the left, and they operate the same way, whether it's co-opting the press or influencing the media or not really being honest. But I too, was surprised. I actually expected that your polls were not going to be honest, as ours were not. But they were. That's kind of a big...
No, actually, they were. Yeah, they were. That was one of the questions I was discussing with my friends, whether Macron, who for sociologic reasons, perhaps, is co-opted by the press, by the leading press, the established press. We asked ourselves whether his percentage was going to be overestimated, and it wasn't. It wasn't. In fact, there is an event here. He reached the first step, and that's clearly very new. The fact that Mrs. Le Pen reaches the second round is an event in itself, certainly, but it's not new to us, because her father had done the same in the 2002 presidential race. So the fact that the National Front reaches the second round of the presidential election is certainly striking news, but it's not entirely new. It happened already. What is really new is the fact that in front of her, you have a candidate who neither comes from the traditional right nor from the traditional left. So that is very new, and it was accurately evaluated by the polls, so that there was no misinterpretation of the intentions of voters here, and this is clearly the striking element in that result.
Yeah, let me just say, Macron is 39 years old. He is young. He was just, his experience is pretty much that he was an economy minister under François Hollande. And he established his own party. And interesting, this is just a sidebar, and I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but he's got a wife who's 25 years older than he is. Is she involved in his political career in some way, or is this just a fluke?
Yeah, she appears with him in public. He describes that situation as having an atypical family. You know, this echoes in some way the debate over the gay marriage, which is still relatively fresh in everybody's memories. She is present. It is said that she gets prepared to be first lady, and well, that's probably one of your questions. But I believe this is a relatively reasonable prediction. So that's what I would say as far as Brigitte Macron is concerned. As far as Macron himself is concerned, this is right. He was a minister. He was a minister. He broke up with the left executive 1 year ago, and just in 1 year, thanks to what Morton Blackwell could call political technology, he succeeded in creating a political force. So that is very remarkable. Of course, it leaves many questions unanswered, because Emmanuel Macron is ambivalent in many regards, and of course he had to be ambivalent in some way in order to succeed, because there was no history. So he had perhaps the necessity to court and woo electors of different types, but it is true that he created a blast in our election, and that blast is the fact that he left behind, of course, François Fillon, who was the candidate of the traditional right, but also Benoît Hamon, who makes the worst result of the whole history of the French Socialist Party.
Oh, yes. So what, 3% or 4%?
3%.
Yeah. Let me explain.
There was never such a bad result in that election. Of course, the left suffered many defeats, but to that level, it is absolutely unheard of.
Yeah, let me just explain.
Also remarkable.
Let me explain just for a second, Sean. Let me explain that Hollande is part of this. Hollande, the president, current president, is a socialist, is the Socialist Party.
Yeah.
And so the point you're making is that they just got trounced 6% only. Jean, yeah. Before we're going to run out of time here, and I want to get in some. Do you think it is an absolute certainty that Marie Le Pen cannot win this runoff? Because it doesn't seem like it. Everybody's jumping to support Macron. What do you think?
Yeah, well, of course, here again, you may say the media, the establishment, the polls are saying things which may prove untrue. But if you do the math here, honestly, I don't really see how she could make it. Because the left, the traditional left, represented by Hamon, of course, it's not much, will vote entirely for Macron. Most of the voters of Mr. Mélenchon, which is the strong man in the left after Mr. Macron, because that's one of the striking elements of that election too. Hamon, the candidate of the Socialist Party, is far behind not only Macron, but also Mélenchon, who is an articulate far-left candidate, but who's also speaking to those who don't like the European Union, and this guy has 19%.
Yeah.
So that's very striking. Indeed, Hollande must read that election as a very strong shot against him, but he managed to avoid that by supporting Macron.
Yes.
He said it in a way that was not so clear, and he will say it, of course, between the first and the second round.
Okay, let's make, before we run out of time, the differences between Macron and Le Pen are vast. And for instance, one thing that will affect us, all of us, the world really, in terms of the economy, is the difference on the EU. Now, Macron is for staying. He's all in for the European Union, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a clear-cut split here between on the Europe that is entirely clear. Macron was one of the most clearly in favor of the European Union, not only the mere principle of it, but also the way it works currently, of course, with some adaptations, perhaps some reforms, but he's a pro-EU candidate. Marine Le Pen is just the contrary.
Yes.
Now, if you take the economy, it's also a very clear-cut split, because the National Front, which in the 80s was, it adhered to the Reaganomics, basically. It was more or less a free market political party, with more nationalism, of course, but still open to free markets. Now it is a party that is mostly sticking to blue collars. Anti-capitalism, anti-free markets, in favor of small businesses, of course, but Macron is just the opposite. Macron comes from the left in some way, but is pro-business, and is viewed as someone pro-business.
Okay, so that's why... People here this morning commentating are saying that Macron would be better just in terms of money, nothing else, not talking about immigration, on which Marie Le Pen, of course, is the hardliner. Oh, we're out of time, Sean, and I'm so sorry. We have to talk again, but maybe on May the 8th, we can talk again about what happens in this runoff election. But again, Jean Martinez is a lawyer with the Bar of Marseille, and we will continue to pray for you. I know there are riots in the street right now as a result of this election. It just seems like the unrest is... we're having a bit of unrest ourselves, so we're kind of in this together, and so we'll continue to pray and remember the people of France. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
Ryan DeFreitas. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFreitas' Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFreitas' Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Pre-order your copy today at afastore.net.
Here's Steve Russo with Real Answers. All around me, I see families being stressed out and fractured because of the lack of forgiveness. It's destroying more homes today than anything else. Isn't it amazing how we can forgive just about anyone else outside the family? Yet we let anger toward a loved one turn into bitterness when we refuse to forgive. Forgiveness literally means to let it go. Are you harboring bitterness in your heart today? Bitterness can fester and build until it consumes us. What is lack of forgiveness doing to you? How long will you refuse to forgive? The problem is, it's hard to forgive someone else until you've experienced it for yourself. Why not try some timeless advice from the Bible? Forgive as the Lord forgave you.
For real answers to real issues, log on to Steve's website, www.realanswers.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Paul Kizito. I'm a junior biology major here at Truett McConnell, and I came from Uganda. What I love about TMU is number one is the heart of, you know, of just the school and the love for God, for Christ. You can see it once you step on the campus. Like, you can see it's best, like, the foundation for TMU is Christianity.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
When President Obama promised to fundamentally transform America, we had no idea he was secretly plotting to ban biscuits and grits. The 2010 Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act effectively banned grits, one of the four major food groups of the South. I'm fairly certain, had Southerners known President Obama had taken away their biscuits and grits, Mitt Romney would have won the South in a landslide. A delegation of school nutritionists is urging Congress for a little flexibility. For example, the only biscuits they can serve have to be made from 100% whole grain. Now, no self-respecting Southerner would ever eat such an atrocity. Like Grandmother Starnes said, biscuits should only be made from buttermilk and Martha White flour, the way the good Lord intended. The federal government needs to stop cooking our grits and stay out of our pantries. We the people should rise up and tell Uncle Sam to kiss our grits. I'm Todd Stearns.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
You're going to do health care and tax reform?
We'll see what happens. No particular rush, but we'll see what happens.
President Trump's upbeat remarks this afternoon about a revamped health care plan, just a week before the federal government runs out of money, stands in stark contrast to growing fears of another potential government shutdown. A key House source tells Fox News that negotiations on a new spending bill are, quote, ongoing and progressing, and that a government shutdown is not on the table. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney is also confident they'll get a deal, but on Thursday, he threw a wrench into the works when he told the Associated Press that Democratic negotiators need to agree to fund some of President Trump's top priorities, including a down payment on a border wall and hiring of additional immigration agents. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's office fired back late today, quote, if the administration would drop their 11th hour demand for a wall that Democrats and a good number of Republicans oppose, congressional leaders could quickly reach a deal. Asked after Mulvaney's remarks whether the wall funding is a budget deal breaker, counselor to the president Kellyanne Conway played it safe.
I'm going to let OMB Director Mick Mulvaney and the President and others address that, but we're confident that the government will not be shut down next week.
Conway's circumspection may also stem from knowing the Democrats are making their own budget demands, further risking a government shutdown.
We have Democrats saying they want Obamacare payments
into this funding bill. So Republicans are not going to like that. So there is certainly some brinkmanship going on, and I think this is going to take some twists and turns. But at the end of the day, I think they'll get a deal done.
Indeed, late today, Mulvaney announced such an offer, an even trade of Obamacare cost-sharing reductions for a border wall.
We've finally boiled this negotiation down to something that we want very badly, that the Democrats really don't like. We'd offer them $1 of CSR payments for $1 of wall payments right now. That's the offer that we've given to our Democrat colleagues.
And Democrats don't like it. Just within the past hour, Nancy Pelosi's spokesman called Mulvaney the architect of one government shutdown and accused him of engineering another.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was Doug McElway of Fox News. Actually, that was last Friday, but this is a big week in Congress, and you need to know that because you're going to be hearing, you know, pillar to post discussions of what's going on there between the fact that the government will shut down on Friday if they don't make some sort of a decision on the budget. You know, I was just thinking, can you imagine if the government should shut down over the Democrats not wanting to fund a border wall? I just wonder about that. I wonder about the optics of that. I'll ask Daniel in just a second on that. They're also talking about tax reform. The president says he's going to present a plan this Wednesday of some sort. The budget is very controversial. President Trump issued what he called the skinny budget, which was actually a very good budget, but it was not thorough. Then there's this the Democrats threatening again to shut the government down, which is what they would do. You know, they always put it on the Republicans, and the Republicans always take it because they don't know how to talk about it, and they're scared to death, and so they're already shouting in sound bites about, oh, we're not going to shut down the government. They're not willing to shut down the government really over anything because they can't articulate or fight back. They seem incapable. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of health care. So no one knows all of these complex issues better than my next guest. Daniel Horowitz is a senior editor for Conservative Review. And, you know, you're familiar with his voice. He's with us a lot because I look to Daniel for a lot of information on Capitol Hill. He seems to have a great grasp of so many details. And so, Daniel, thank you for once again joining us this morning.
Great to be with you. And, yes, Sandy, this is a week when details will matter.
Yeah, you know, can you imagine? Oh, let's go to the fun first. This is fun, projected fun on my part. If the government should shut down over a border wall, wonder how that would play in the press. I just wonder.
Well, it's the same thing over that or over funding Planned Parenthood, but unfortunately the Republicans aren't even fighting that battle. But you're absolutely right. This time, Republicans have not just both houses of Congress, but they have control of the White House, so they could actually frame the issue of a government shutdown and orchestrate it. If you remember last time, a couple of years ago when we had a government shutdown, Obama would gratuitously cause pain by sending out troopers to shut down national monuments for no reason. And then the media would focus on the optics. Here, Trump could actually focus on, not just the issues over which we have the budget brinkmanship, but actually demonstrate the areas of government that are extra and not needed, because you'll have all the non-essential personnel won't come in and people will miss them.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a thought? What a thought. But of course, they have they'll probably get an extension. They'll probably not make a decision because they never do in a timely fashion. So I expect there's going to be an extension. I don't know if you would agree with me on that. But all right, I want to talk to you first about health reform, Daniel, because I'm hearing all these murmurings, and we know that Mark Meadows and other members of the Freedom Caucus have been negotiating with the so-called Tuesday group, with so-called moderate Republicans. I really am confused about where that is. What do you know about that?
Sure. I think the important thing is, before we get bogged down in any of the details and the minutiae of this debate, there's a broader picture here. Most Republicans don't want to repeal Obamacare, period. I mean, that is the bigger thing. You know, why does Mark Meadows and the conservatives, why do they have to negotiate to get as much partial repeal as they possibly can? Why should they have to negotiate with their own members of the party who actually made the same promise they did to fully repeal it? So what's very clear is they are not repealing the heart and soul of Obamacare, the regulations and the subsidies, or they're just replacing regs and subsidies with more regs and subsidies. Now it's just a matter of whether Meadows, knowing that these people absolutely will not do what they promised to do, could he secure maybe some waivers to states to allow them to ask HHS to get rid of some of the regulations. But many of us fear that that is not enough of a permanent paradigm shift in the marketplace. It's too tenuous to significantly drive down prices and bring new insurers back in.
But Daniel, what's this thing about letting the states decide about, I guess it's the high-risk pools, letting the states opt out individually if they don't want to cover, I don't know if it was pre-existing conditions or a catastrophic illness. Can you kind of clarify that?
Sure. So obviously the heart and soul of Obamacare, just real basic, what is Obamacare? Obamacare is the imposition of actuarially insolvent regulations on the marketplace, you know, telling insurers you have to cover everything under every circumstance at the same price as the community. You might hear that term being thrown around, community rating. Well, that's not insurance. I mean, the whole point of insurance is that it has to be a hedge against risk. It has to be actuarially solvent. So that's why the price has just skyrocketed, and that's why many states only have one or two insurers left. And, you know, if you have one insurer left in a state like in Alaska, well, what happens? You have a monopoly, and insurance premiums are now up to $50,000 in Alaska, and, you know, as well as some other places. So basically, Republicans don't want to get rid of that. They're too scared to message it. Oh, my gosh, what are we going to do with pre-existing conditions? Well, you know, our point is that is what made Obamacare insolvent. And if you want to keep that, then you're not going to drive down prices. You're not going to heal the market. The way to deal with that is through these separate high-risk pools. Now, Republicans are sticking high-risk pools into their bill. The problem is they're not repealing the regulations at a federal level. They're offering states the option of getting rid of some. Now, that sounds great, but here's the problem. Real federalism means the federal government gets out of the way. And then if states want to reimpose those regulations, they could do that. This is the opposite. The default position is Obamacare state. If you have a handful of governors that request a waiver, they might get it. Let me ask you something, Sandy. How many governors are going to do that? I mean, the same way you have all these rhino congressmen that don't want to get rid of it, I got news for you. You got governors like John Kasich, certainly the Democrat ones, who will never ask for waivers.
And just to be clear, Daniel, for people who have pre-existing conditions and are listening to this and are saying, hey, that would adversely affect me. The point is you would provide for them in a different way. It would be outside of the scope of the federal would not be factored into the federal program. It would be high-risk pools, which would allow people to still be covered, but it would not boost costs for everyone in the whole world. It's a better way of managing it. I think it cuts out the middleman a lot more, doesn't it? Maybe just cuts out some of the costs.
Yeah, well, it's more than that. You know, what we learned throughout Obamacare, which should have been very obvious to everyone until now, is that you can't deal with pre-existing conditions in a general market, because then what happens is everyone pays the price of sick people. And then, like I said, worse, it drives insurers out of the market, which creates an even bigger monopoly, which raises costs even more. You have to isolate and minimize the problem. And ultimately, you have to heal the individual market by allowing individuals with pre-tax dollars to purchase any plan they like and insurers to offer any plan they like outside of the confines of regulations and subsidies. Because let's not forget, the subsidies also drive up the cost. If I tell insurers that, hey, Don't worry. We're going to subsidize the consumers to purchase anything you sell. Well, then they'll inflate prices, you know, theoretically to $50,000 a year for premiums, knowing that anyone earning under $90,000 or such will get government subsidies. You need them to compete for consumer demand, not through the narrow confines of government regulations and subsidies.
But Daniel, doesn't look like that's ever going to happen. I mean, you've got the Freedom Caucus again, bringing down their standards in order to reach some sort of a deal, because President Trump wants a deal. And so it seems like the whole notion of free market health care is just totally gone. And you make the point in your most current article, and I think you're absolutely right about this for a number of reasons, is that the medical plan, whatever they come up with, if it looks anything like what they're working on, it will sink the economy. It will be kind of like the nail in the coffin. And that's not a quantum leap to say that. I always think of Romney Care, Massachusetts, which he was so proud of. It was like federalized, only it was statewide health insurance. And what happened was it was such a great plan, but it was not such a great plan because it ended up going in the red every year, and it was federal tax dollars that still has to bail out Massachusetts because of their statewide insurance. So I say all that to say it's not possible to pay for everybody's medical needs 100%. It will bankrupt any country. But I should let you comment on that.
No, absolutely. But it's not just the federal government's budget. It's the family budget. It's the market price. All it does is engender a further need for subsidization and distort the market and raise prices. You can't tax, regulate, and subsidize your way into solvency. That's what the past few years has taught us, and really what the past couple of decades. We spend about $1.6 trillion, with a T, per year on healthcare between combined federal and state expenditures on Medicare, Medicaid, state programs, the VA. And again, at some point, you have to get back to the marketplace. The best we can do is you isolate and minimize the problem of pre-existing conditions by driving down the cost, by offering a climate where the big insurers and their lobbyists don't have a monopoly over the industry, and new insurers could enter the market and instill a sense of innovation like Uber and Amazon.
Yeah.
Part of why you don't have that in healthcare is because it's government run. I mean, it's a zombie private sector that's very narrowly channeled, like I said, through the confines of regulations and subsidies. If everyone had to compete for consumer market demand, most people would be very happy, lower cost, and then the price to government to deal with those chronically ill people would be more minimal than it is now.
Okay, one more question on that, then we need to move on. Do you think they're actually going to reach an agreement? I hear everything. I hear, yes, it's imminent. Yes, there's a plan. Yes, there's something in writing. And then I hear, no, not yet. So what do you think?
No, I think they are going to. It's not going to be something we like, but what I'm hearing is the conservatives ultimately feel that they have no room to run. That Trump and the congressional leaders made it very clear they are getting health care done. Now, again, notice I didn't say free market or conservative or repeal of Obamacare, but they need to show they're getting something done, just to pass something. And conservatives are just trying to get the best they can on state waivers, and that's it. So, again, it will be there at a federal level, some flexibility for states on the regulations, but the Medicaid expansion is going to be there. The subsidies are, for the most part, going to be there. I do see it happening. I see a deal being announced this week, and maybe they'll vote on it next week.
All right, let's talk about taxes. You know, ironically, people are, the protesters in the streets, at least last week, were demanding that we see Donald Trump's taxes. We must make them public. But, the irony is probably most of those people marching in the street were not even paying any taxes. In fact, half of all Americans do not pay federal income taxes. Let me give some of the stats that you give actually in your article here. The top 1% in a survey that was done in 2014, the top 1% paid 39.5% of all federal income taxes, even though they just earned 20% of the income. The top 5% of income earners paid 60% of income taxes, even though they earned just 36% of the income. And the bottom 50% paid just 2.75% of income taxes, even though they earned 11% of the income pie. So, and you explained that, of course, that was actually a combination of Bush and Reagan policies that kept reducing taxes, and also then some Obama changes that has created a situation where really is only the wealthy that are paying taxes. And so when you give a tax break, you are giving a tax break to the wealthy because they're the only ones paying taxes. Now, did I summarize that pretty well there, Daniel?
You know, what they say in our circles is there's not a lot of juice to squeeze out of that anymore. And the point is, look, as conservatives, there's a lot we can do on taxes. But there's a certain political reality, especially given the terrible messaging apparatus in this party. They run up against this problem every time. Well, oh my gosh, we can't be perceived as giving a tax to the rich. So they just wind up making the tax code even more progressive. And that's my concern, and that's why I really don't want to touch this issue, because to give an sports analogy here, I just think they're going to toss an interception instead of picking, throwing a touchdown once you pick up that ball. so it's better just to leave it on the ground at this point. I would focus more on regulations. The average family pays about $15,000 a year in the hidden tax of regulations, and that's something that's very regressive. Everyone pays it, you know, or maybe do a straight-up 35% to 25% corporate tax cut. The problem is once they start playing around with bigger stuff and it becomes comprehensive, it winds up becoming more liberal. And then there's also the budgetary problems that they're spending so much money, so they're going to have scoring issues on giving tax cuts. And, you know, all this stuff, again, conservatives, as conservatives, we have our own philosophy on this, but we are not driving the ship. And guess who's writing the plan, by the way? Gary Cohn, Steven Mnuchin, these are all Democrats.
Yeah, that's and the way to understand that is that we have a healthcare plan that really is in the mode of the Democratic model of socialism, and that's what the leadership in the House is pushing. So your point is that do not think that if tax reform is offered, it's going to be the same but different. It will be a tax reform package that represents the interest and values of the Democrats, because it's Democrats in the Trump cabinet and a Trump administration that are actually would be making this tax plan. So beware. And then, of course, Daniel, we have the border. And, in fact, let's stop just for a second. Nancy Pelosi said this yesterday, and I just want to play it, and then we'll talk. Here's Nancy Pelosi.
The president talks about how tall it is, who's going to pay for it, and all the rest of that. But you have to come. You have to understand this part of the country. There's a community with a border going through it. The president, I think, talking about this wall, is expressing a sign of weakness. He's saying, I can't control our borders. I have to build a wall.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Every time she talks, I have to laugh, but she's very clever. She's dumb like a fox. Nancy Pelosi is talking about the border issue, which, of course, Donald Trump has promised almost, probably in every campaign and appearance, he promised to build a border and make Mexico pay for it. So now the Democrats are digging in their heels, saying that they are not going to accept any kind of budget. I remember that the government is scheduled to shut down this Friday if there is no budget agreement, that they're going to shut it down. Or no, they're not saying that. They're saying Republicans, of course, will shut it down. But it is because the president wants funding for the border wall, and they are digging in their heels saying there's no way they're going to do this. Daniel, your comments on this, and how do you see this thing playing out?
Sure. So there's two issues here. There's really the broad budget brinkmanship, and then there's the issue of immigration and the border. As far as the border fence, I have two pieces out of Conservative Review going through the cost-benefit analysis of it. There really is nothing as effective as a fixed deterrent like a border fence. You certainly find that in Israel, and you find it in the few places where we constructed a double-layer security barrier in San Diego and Yuma, Arizona. But it was just kind of a couple of small urban areas. If we would do that across at least 800 miles, it would actually stop the flow. And it's more than people think. Just last week, and we have a piece on this, a Conservative Review, the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security came out with a report showing how the ICE agents are overwhelmed just trying to deport the people for whom there are final deportation orders that actually went through the system. And, you know, it's pretty hard to get deported, so you have to be pretty bad. There's about a million of them, 10,000 per ICE agent with each, in some of the jurisdictions. And basically, a lot of them work 18-hour days, and they still don't have time to deal with them. And what happens is after a number of months, the courts mandate, and this is a whole other issue with the courts getting involved, they mandate that thousands of them get released into our communities. Officially, they're supervised by ICE, but they lose track of them, and they disappear into the population. So interior enforcement is very cumbersome. It's very costly. It's not working, and we're losing them. So think about all the funds you're saving by not having them come here to begin with. And even when we successfully deport people, which is pretty rare, it takes forever. It comes at such a huge cost, the court costs, the detention costs and everything. So that all has to be taken into account in the cost-benefit analysis. I once worked it out that we would make back the cost within a couple of months of preventing a new flow of illegal aliens.
Wow, you should publish that again. So how do you see this playing out? Now, the Democrats are digging in their heels, Daniel, on the wall. This is a Trump's signature promise, really, during his campaign. And Americans pretty much are divided, I think, on this issue. So how do you see this playing out?
You know, what's a shame is everything has to become partisan. I've watched this issue for years and polling on the border fence. Because keep in mind, this existed long before Trump. It was actually the Jim DeMint border fence. But, you know, Obama stopped constructing it after the first 36 miles. It enjoyed 70-80% approval. And the problem is now it's associated with Trump, so it becomes partisan. The big mistake the administration made is, again, they led from behind. They allowed for weeks for congressional rhinos to negotiate away their leverage to the Democrats and basically just do what they always do and say, oh, we're so scared of a shutdown. Please, Democrats, what does it take to get you to support a bill? And they're like, well, you know, fund Planned Parenthood, fund refugee resettlement. Oh, and don't fund the border fence. Now, in the 11th hour, Trump is rightfully saying, no, wait a minute, this is a priority, we need it. But it's tough because, like I said, Democrats are already got the better of them. But I think we need to remember, Republicans control all three branches. If they cannot win a budget battle with such power, it's like being run over by a parked car.
Yeah, and we need to point out what we always say, and to say it again. I remember that Speaker Ryan made a little tour with Luis Gutierrez, the leftist open borders socialist, a congressman from Illinois, because they are on the same page when it comes to the border. So don't be shocked when Paul Ryan does not want to build a border fence, or the rest of the leadership who follow him. And so that's what's going on. One last thing about this, Daniel. This whole business of pay for, if you increase, cut a dollar, you've got to increase a dollar, just, you know, trying to, no, if you're going to have more spending, you have to find ways to reduce it. I think that, didn't that start under Boehner?
Well, no, that's, it started really a while ago. It's written into the congressional rules called pay-go, pay-as-you-go.
Yeah.
There's a number of ways to get around it.
Well, what do you think about it, though? I mean, what do you think about it? Initially, I remember when it was first introduced, I thought it was a pretty good idea. But now it seems to be, okay, this is the other side of it, is that if you're going to try to get the economy going, you're going to have to spend some money and step out there a little bit in order to get the engine going, in order to bring back the revenue to get out of debt. Would you agree with that?
Well, there's two things. I mean, number one, if we were in charge, believe me, there's plenty we'd cut. So you would have pay-go. We would cut. But I think you're talking about the tax cuts, you know, so-called paying for the tax cuts. Philosophically, I agree with you. If we are going to spend money and flush it down the toilet on stimulus, on stuff like that, on entitlements and welfare, and not pay for it, then you know what? We're going to give people back some of their money. And that will really stimulate the economy and ultimately bring in more revenue, and we're not going to pay for it. But again, I just don't think that's on the menu. I just don't think Republicans are going to articulate that. So once they talk about this so-called revenue-neutral tax reform, I just don't see any good coming out of it.
You know what else is that? This is just a practical aside here. Isn't Congress still out of session? Is this part of their 7 days of being in session this week?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, the Senate does come back this afternoon. The House is back Tuesday, tomorrow, after 2 weeks of being off. So, look, and this is the problem, that the leaders don't sit and bang on the lectern the way the Democrats do and say, we will fund our priorities. The main job of the federal government is to protect our national sovereignty, our security. It's not to fund a private organization under investigation for harvesting baby organs. You know, it's not to be the world's refugee intake. The problem is they don't do that. They just say, well, you know, we have to make sure there's no government shutdown.
Yeah, exactly.
They're completely off message.
Yeah, and totally. Well, Daniel, thank you. We can always count on you to kind of hone all this complication down. By the way, his latest article, 6 Reasons to be Skeptical of Rhino Tax Reform, we'll put on our Facebook page. And whatever else you've written, Daniel, lately that you'd like for us to post, we will absolutely do that. Conservative Review is a great source of information, a trusted source, just so long as you know that. Daniel Horowitz, thank you for joining me this morning. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. The first recorded account of good versus evil came in the Garden of Eden when the devil asked, "Did God really say?" And bam, moral relativism was born. Make no mistake, there is good and there is evil. There is the sacred and the profane, and God is the one who defines these things. Very few people intentionally teach their children these differences, neither by talking with them nor by their lives, while many public schools advertently and inadvertently teach our children that moral good and evil are but mere opinion. Parents and grandparents, use every moment wisely, instructing the children in your life about good and evil according to the Word of God. Proverbs 22:6 explains, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." This is a Decency Minute. Find us at AmericanDecency.org. I'm Bill Johnson.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
To sharpen the faith of Christians and to share the good news of Jesus Christ with those who don't know Him. That is the mission of the Christian Worldview Radio program. This is host David Wheaton inviting you to join us this Saturday morning at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, to pursue that mission as we discuss a compelling topic from a decidedly biblical perspective. The Christian Worldview, Saturday mornings at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, right here on AFR Talk.
8 Days of Hope 13 is headed to Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. Hi, I'm Steve Tiber with 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope is a faith-based ministry. We've gone all over the country to help families rebuild after natural disasters. We've helped almost 1,800 families rebuild their homes, sometimes from the ground up. Lafayette, Louisiana, and the whole state of Louisiana got hit by epic flooding last year in August. Almost 25 inches of rain fell, and almost $20 billion of damage was done. Literally 140,000 homes flooded. Think about that, 140,000 families waiting for somebody to be a glimpse of Jesus. You can be a skilled professional, or you can be somebody like me who's less skilled but wants to give back. Go to 8daysofhope.com. We provide the food and lodging, and you can learn a lot more about the ministry. And we can't wait to see you in Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. After the Democrats' drubbing in the 2016 election, one would have thought they would be reluctant to oppose Donald Trump on his signature issue of securing America's southern border. The public wants it done, and made Mr. Trump president to do that. In addition, congressional Democrats had previously voted to build the wall. But now, Democratic legislators are saying they'll shut down the government rather than approve funding for this purpose. Perhaps that's in part because they know the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill doesn't want to see Mr. Trump's promise fulfilled either. I say, bring it on. Republicans who help Democrats undermine our national security should be primaried, and Democrats beholden to government labor unions must be put on notice that federal employees identified as non-essential in case of governmental shutdown will be the first fired when budget cuts have to be made. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. A lot of things. Let's see. Trying to figure out which way to go. I think, North Korea, of course, is continuing to do what they're doing. They're threatening now to shoot down a ship that's in the waterways close to them. Excuse me. They're calling it, they said there are revolutionary forces are combat ready to sink a U.S. nuclear-powered aircraft carrier with a single strike. We called it our ship a gross animal on all kinds of threats. It's really pretty amazing. And then really foreboding to me is that they have arrested a third U.S. citizen who was at the airport. His name, they call him Kim, and they said he has been a professor at the Yonbian University of Science and Technology. but he was engaged in aid and relief programs in North Korea. We don't know much about him, and of course, it makes me think of the Koreans that I knew that were involved in those relief efforts on the Tumon River to help people who were trying to escape and who were, of course, I don't know anything about this, Kim, but I bet you dollars to donuts that he's a Christian, just because those are the people that are taking the risks to go over there and do what they can to help. So now he's being detained, and of course, who knows how he'll be treated, and of course, he'll be used as some sort of a negotiating tool, I'm sure. China's trying to help, but I don't exactly know what they are doing, but that issue is getting more serious. It can be funny, I guess, when you think of Kim Jong-un. He could be very funny if he weren't so dangerous. And of course, I've already explained to you that they have the capability of hitting the west coast of the United States, and of course, the west coast of Canada, too. And of course, their neighbors, if they wanted to, with nuclear devices. They have just a few more. They're not quite there, but they have the power to boost if they can develop this nuclear weaponry to put on their boosters. And so it is a very dangerous thing. Meanwhile, it looks as though there's some sort of a conference for spy chiefs around the globe in New Zealand. The New Zealand Herald caught a picture of James Comey getting out of a car for this conference out of a private plane. They say New Zealand is part of the Five Eyes, what's called the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Network. So the spooks are meeting in New Zealand. Of course, do we really want to know that? I guess now it's not possible to do anything without everyone knowing about it. Donald Trump is coming up to his 100th day, and of course, there's a lot of talk about that, much made about a president's first 100 days in office and what he's accomplished. I have to tell you, I think President Trump has done an amazing job. Knowing what I know about the opposition in the White House, the jockeying for power, whether it's the establishment Republicans, whether it's the outright Democrats who work there, or whether it's the Never Trumpers, it's just an amazing thing that he really has been able to do what he's done. The regulations that he has turned back from the environment the school regulations about forcing schools to open their bathrooms to all genders. There have been so many regulations. I have to make a list so I can recite them to you. But it has been an amazing thing what he has done with that. Planned Parenthood, you know, not forcing the states. Reversing a rule that Obama wrote in December of 2016, forcing states to fund Planned Parenthood. An 11th hour, a chance to help Planned Parenthood before the president, meaning Obama, who loved abortion of all kinds, always, ever since I have followed his career, his last, you know, attempt to help Planned Parenthood. And so President Trump reversed that. And so thank God for that. And many, many more things. And no one works really as hard as this president. There's no question about it. So Washington Post did a poll, and they said, If Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were to run today for the president, or at least when they took the poll, a popular vote, people would vote for Donald Trump 43% to 40%. That's pretty amazing when you listen to the headlines and you think that, you know, he's the worst president ever. I was just reading a report about Germany and how appalled they are by what they're hearing about the president. But all they're seeing is, you know, the international news, the CNN and others. And so I think when I talk to people in this country, they're pretty happy right now with what they're seeing. So we'll talk more about that because this is the 100-day marker this week. Well, this has been Sandy Rios on this Monday morning from AFR Talk. Be back tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.